Perry Morissette, the Godfather,
the legend.
All right, enough of that.
Welcome to Backtracks Aerosmith Revisited. My name is Corey Morissette, the Godfather of Rock and Roll Podcasting. Joining us, as always, is the sexiest man in rock and roll podcasting, Scott Haskin. How you doing, Scott?
Well, I don't know if I can compare to that introduction so much that you had. I did a seated standing salute that people couldn't see. It was a lot of effort.
I saw it and I appreciated it. Thank you very much. And joining us, of course, as always, he's everybody's favorite grumpy old troll who lives under the bridge, John Mariano. How you doing, John?
I'm doing much better now that I've seen the tip of Scott's erection. I mean, of his standing ovation.
I love doing the show.
John's always been a big fan of Just the Tip, and you must be a big fan of Aerosmith if you clicked on this train wreck here tonight. We're the only podcast that is breaking down the entire Aerosmith discography, one random track at a time. We are endeavoring to compile the ultimate Aerosmith mixtape, side A, all deep cuts, side B, all live cuts, side C, all hits, side D. Those are our nasty cuts. Those are the three tracks that we just love and have to put on a mixtape somewhere. Gentlemen, I made a mistake last week, and this is very rare. I never, ever make mistakes, but I'm going to own up to it here tonight. Last week, we rolled The Hand That Feeds from Draw the Line. And I said, erroneously said that John put that on the dice. He didn't. I actually did. So John went and picked a terrible song to put on there, and it'll stay on there. But I just wanted to own up to my mistake. So now there's three John tracks on the dice, only one of mine, and two Scott's that are irrelevant because they never roll. So this is your opportunity to chastise me and make me feel bad for my very rare error.
So I just want to, I mean, that's fine. It's been great doing the show with you, Corey. We'll miss you. But I'm wondering, it's been picking Mariano songs like left and right for weeks, and now it has three to choose from?
I know. Doesn't seem fair, right?
This game is leveled.
And I agree with Scott. This game is fucked. And it's partly your fault, Corey, and I'm protesting.
Okay.
And I would like to submit a formal protest.
Okay.
I'm going to slide it over to Corey right now. I think that it might be fair to take one of my songs off the dice, but they'll probably come off as I roll. But I think, in fairness, I really shouldn't be punished here. I didn't do anything wrong.
That's true.
So if we're going to take one of my songs off the dice, we should probably take one of Scott's songs off the mixtape.
All right. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking it's fair. It's like a little, you know, coomsie, coomsie, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Right. So the coomsie is we take one of my songs off the dice.
Okay.
The coomsie is we also remove the movie from the mixtape.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Scott, what do you think?
I don't see how that relates in the slightest.
Scott, I am at some point going to be punished for something I didn't do. It's only fair that the same happens to you.
See, this is why I stopped dating, because this is the kind of shenanigans that would happen. And, you know, I pay for dinner and then I'm just out $50. I kind of feel like that here.
I tell you, you stop dating because there's not a woman on the planet that can deal with the animal magnetism that is Scott Haskin. We all know this. So we have a proposal on the table from John that we take one of his songs off the die and we take the movie off. So, you know, fair is fair, right? Does that work for you, Scott?
I know, because I labeled it in green. So that means I really like it. Oh. And I've got two songs that are yellow on John's list. So, I mean, if anything needs to go.
So, Scott, let me help you out here.
It's probably Janie's like, got a gun.
It sounds like you're upset with me.
Oh, no.
That shouldn't be the case. It feels like you're attacking me, but you're trying to take my stuff off the mixtape. And what I'm trying to say is I'm not trying to do that to you. I am being punished because Corey screwed up. And you should also be punished because Corey screwed up. So if you should be mad at anybody right now, I want to take it out on Corey.
I guess where I'm lost is what the actual punishment is, because Corey said it would stay on there for now. So eventually, really, you're getting like, you know, you bought a pack of gum and for some reason there's five extra sticks in there.
Eventually,
and you're complaining that you have extra gum to chew.
Eventually, one of my songs comes off the mixtape and I don't get to replace it. That's a punishment.
Is it though?
Corey, whose side are you on?
I'm not on any side. I'm trying to play devil's advocate.
I mean, just because it's going to be Walk on Water doesn't mean that that's really punishment. I think that's just justice.
All right. You know what? Why don't we roll this die so that way we can get to I'm Down, and then I can have four songs on the mixtape.
Sure. If we roll a Scott, you just pick a song, put it on the die.
Yeah.
Is it December already?
You know what? It might as well be here in Canada. We're taping this a few weeks ahead, but we just got dumped with 2 feet of snow last Thursday and Friday. One of the worst winter storms. We set a record, I guess, in North America for most snow at the end of April. So that's something.
Congratulations.
But no, it fucking sucks. It was absolutely terrible. But we do have a piece of Aerosmith news. We should maybe chat a little bit. Now, as we record this, nothing is official. But as John pointed out, on the Aerosmith website, there's a countdown clock. And it's currently counting down to about 8 a.m. Eastern time on May 1st. The big rumor from my sources tells me that Aerosmith, and by Aerosmith, I mean probably just Joe Perry and Steven Tyler, are going to be on the Howard Stern show on Monday, May 1st. And they're going to announce a big 40-plus date North American tour that's probably going to be billed as a farewell tour. So this might be our last chance to ever see Aerosmith live and in concert. And it may not even be all of them, because Joe Perry mentioned as he was kind of talking about this that Joey Kramer may not be physically up to performing. He just lost his wife not that long ago. He didn't take part in the residency. Joe alluded to the fact that he's just kind of beat up after 50 years of banging the drums around. That if you watch his solos, during his drum solo, he's hitting the cymbals in the toms with his head. So that might have something to do with it too. I don't know. But here's hoping that Joey can come out at least for a part of this Arrivederci tour that Aerosmith is probably going to be embarking on starting this year.
Yeah, it'd be nice if he could at least do maybe the last four or five shows, you know, to jump in for that, not to screw over whoever's filling in and keeping the band going. But it would be nice to end it with as many original people as possible.
Mm-hmm. You know what I would like to see? On the last date of this tour, right? Joey shows up. He hasn't played the drums the entire tour. I don't want him to play the drums, though. I want him to... WCW once had this character. There was this wrestler. He went under the name Tugboat. He was Dusty Rhodes' I believe brother-in-law. And he had been rebranded several times over, and they were trying to rebrand him once again. And they rebranded him as a character called the Shockmaster. And the Shockmaster was a Stormtrooper helmet from Star Wars covered in shimmery glitter. I think you see where I'm going here.
You want him to come out as the Shockmaster?
If he's wearing the shimmery helmet, he can shimmer one more time in front of a crowd.
But if he's dressed as a Stormtrooper, he'll never hit anything.
Well, and the problem with the Shockmaster was he was wearing the Stormtrooper helmet and he couldn't see. And he was supposed to, like, he fell through a wall during his intro and the helmet fell off. So he's on the ground trying to get his glittery pink helmet and put it back on his head. And then there was this evil voice, I am the Shockmaster. And it's absolutely hilarious.
Because the other side of that, Scott, is they didn't have enough time to put any microphones inside the helmet. Mm-hmm. So somebody else is off camera doing the voice of the Shockmaster, but can't see what's happening. And I don't know if you remember the actor Sid Vicious.
Yeah.
But Sid Vicious is on camera and trying to yell off camera to tell them what's going on. So that way they could adjust with the voice of like, why I just fell down. But he's not. So he's still doing the intro as he hits the ground. Ric Flair, if you ever see the video, Ric Flair's there at the beginning of the interview and then all of a sudden is gone. Like he knew how bad this thing was going to go.
It reminds me of how bad it was when Kane was the dentist before he became Kane.
Isaac DDS.
Isaac, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, okay, so if Joey can't or isn't interested. Oh my God. If Joey can't or isn't interested, here's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see him at least come out for the very last show and just hit the virus lap for the beginning of Sweet Emotion and then walk off the stage.
That would work.
He's got to do something now.
You see, it's 4-3 here.
Yeah, the British Bulldog, Sting, Sid Vicious, Booker T. Partner is, brother. You better here comes the special tag team partner.
I'll call now when I want to, Sting. It seems to me, if you was as smart as you act like you are,
they're always yelling. Always yelling.
That's the war games to tell everybody who your partner is.
I like the maid that's just standing there in the background enjoying the argument.
Oh, they're going to introduce the partner. Here we go.
Ready? So you see Flair there?
Yeah.
Flair.
He's leaving. He's out of here.
He leaves with Ric Flair leaves with the maid.
Yeah, it's his own maid.
Well, the maid is his eventual wife. They've now been married 30 years.
Oh wow.
The world because
he shocked the world.
None other than the Shock Master!
Right. Oh!
That's not just a stormtrooper helmet. That's a bedazzled silver painted stormtrooper helmet.
And the coat, and then he's wearing jean shorts.
Just to tie it all in, Scott, would you say that's a shimmery helmet?
That's a shimmery helmet, yeah. Wow, Booker T looks so young there.
Oh, listen to the voice.
So you're the man that rules the world. They call me the Shockmaster.
He's got all the glitter on his chest that fell off.
He doesn't even look like he's talking, though.
He's not.
Get ready.
That's the best part. Like, his chest isn't even moving like he's talking.
He's just rubbing his hands together because he's not sure what this guy's going to say.
Come after me, Sid. I'm ready. Along with Davey Boy.
Oh, my God, that. Well, one of the glorious moments in wrestling history, the Shockmaster.
I have one other glorious moment I need to share with you before we start the show.
Okay.
Recently, I have been listening to podcasts, and one of the podcasts I've been listening to is The Blathering over on the Knapsack Network. The Blathering's an off-the-cuff, from-the-hardened-head podcast from comedian and author Ken Knapsack. Written, hosted, performed by Ken Knapsack, co-creator of Four Center, The Knapsack Files, and Pop Rock and Radio. Saturday Night Knapsack is a satirical radio show full of a wide cast of characters, segments, and more. It's a show so real, it had to be fake. So here's what I want you to do. Go to your podcast distributor, your podcast application, whatever you call it, the little podcast feed that you have. And I want you to go to The Knapsack Network, and if you could, leave a rating. Preferably a 5, but let everybody know you're listening and you support him and you think he's great. If you can do that and you can subscribe, all that kind of stuff helps our friend Ken. And I'd really appreciate it.
There you have it. Scott, do you have anything you'd like to share with the class?
Well, you know, not just him, but we have some other friends too. We have the Sean Geek and Fast Fret podcast. And I'll tell you what, guys, if you go just pull them up on your podcast player and just go through the list of their episodes, I guarantee you're going to find tons of stuff you're going to want to listen to. And also while you're at it, check out Eric at the Booked on Rock podcast. Just constantly talking about books and interviewing people about the books that are involved in the music industry. Absolute great stuff. And then there's our ever-growing list of friends at the Deep Dive Podcast Network. John and Corey, our co-hosts here, do a show called Backtracks Theme Music. Excellent, digging into the music and really all about the film that they're talking about. Corey does another show with Mark Kammeyer called And the Podcast Will Rock, all things Van Halen. I've got my Uriah Heep, the Magician's podcast show that will go through early June of 2023, and that will pretty much be the end of that. We have the Deep Purple podcast, Skinnerd Reconsidered, T-Bone's Prime Cuts on the Other Side, Rye at Sabbath Bloody podcast, In the Lap of the Pods, all things Queen. We have the Hawkwind Hawk Binge podcast. We have Maiden A to Z, Diary of the Madmen, the ultimate Aussie podcast. Universally Speaking, the Red Hot Chili Peppers podcast. And I got to tell you guys, I recorded a show with George and Hattie over at Judas Priestcast on Saturday. I think that'll be coming out sometime in May. Had so much fun hanging out with them. And of course, we have the North by South podcast, So Far, So Pod, So What, All Things Megadeth, The Tom Petty Project, the Seaside Pod Review, another Queen show, and Volume for All, covering all things heavy metal. And of course, the Rock Roulette podcast, and our short show regarding Lulu.
That's right. There's a show for everybody on the Deep Dive Podcast Network. Please go check us out, deepdivepodcastnetwork.com. There's links to all the shows on there. And like you said, something for every single taste in music. But if you're here, go ahead.
We need like a Bengals podcast or something that's a little off the path of what we've got. I think we need to round that out a little bit.
Podcast like an Egyptian?
There you go. Done. It's already done. The whole show's completed.
John is scowling. He disagrees.
A Hazy Shade of Podcast.
That's not even their song, though. They just covered it.
I don't care.
Manic Pod Day is better.
What the hell is a pod day?
Doesn't matter. Sounds cool.
You know what? I started off like I was coming in hot on Scott, but the reality is that you didn't side with me in the ever going struggle to get this freaking song off of the mixtape.
Where's the mute button?
I don't like you right now.
Well, you're gonna when I roll one of your songs because it's time. As my dog barks in the background.
50% chance of getting a Mariano song, which is interesting because last week, even though he only had two, we had a 75% chance of getting a Mariano song for like the last 6 weeks.
That's true. The song's on the mixtape. We have the two Scott Haskins songs, I'm Down and You See Me Crying, both of it on there for, 20-some episodes now. Then we got the three Johns, Hole in My Soul, From Little South to Sanity, Out of Your Head, and Light Inside, both from with the Just Push Play. And then I put Jaded on there, also from Just Push Play. So we got a 50% chance of getting a Just Push Play track here tonight. Let's find out what the hell it's going to be. Let's throw it over to Steven Tyler. Toss of the And we're going to get You See Me Crying. Whoa. It's a Scott Haskin track. Not the one everyone was hoping for, but we're going to Toys in the Attic. Scott, the dice don't hate you no more, my friend.
Against all odds, I have conquered.
You want to give a small speech before we play the track here tonight?
I just want to bask in the victory for a minute. This has always been a favorite song of mine, probably one of my favorites on Toys in the Attic. There's just such emotion. I think it's such an incredible vocal from Steven. There's some great string builds in it that we'll talk about. It's just a beautifully done song.
It really is. And this was a single way back. It was released in 1975. Remembrance Day, actually, November 11th, 1975, along with the B-side Toys in the Attic. So it's kind of weird. Toys in the Attic was never an A-side single off of the album of the same name. It's such an iconic song now, but it was the B-side to You See Me Crying.
That's so weird. I would have thought it would have been the other way around, to be honest. Toys in the Attic is such a killer song. It's an excellent song to start the album. It's got all this energy. I would have thought that would have been the single.
John, do you have any recollections of You See Me Crying?
Yeah, I really dig this song. It's on one of the two albums that Scott knows. And I actually prefer this over at least one song on the mixtape.
Okay. You know, before we play it, I really, really want to play my favorite game because I find this very interesting. And we're going to play How Often Did Aerosmith Play You See Me Crying? Remember, this song came out in 1975. So the question is, how many times has Aerosmith played this live? John Mariano, let's start with you.
I'm going to go with 25.
25 times. Scott Haskin?
I'm going 98.
98. You both went over. Oh, that's a shame.
Wow.
When you go over, you got to hear this song right here. One time. Yo.
One time.
According to setlist.fm, Aerosmith played You See Me Crying. Oh, we're going to keep playing Price is Right, apparently. They played Aerosmith played You See Me Crying one time. Bonus points if you can guess the year.
75?
Nope, John.
78.
How about 2009?
That is, can it get more random?
They actually played Toys in the Attic in its entirety on that show.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, so that makes sense.
And apparently it was at the request of Steven Tyler's daughter, Liv Tyler.
Hmm. Well, who's going to deny her? I mean, she was an elf. She was, Ben Affleck's girlfriend.
I can tell you somebody who's not going to deny her. Rex Manning. See, and that falls on deaf ears because nobody on this show has seen Empire Records.
Nope.
That's right. I have not.
But there are people that are listening right now I've now outed both of you to and shamed you publicly about.
There's a lot of movies I haven't seen.
I'm fine with my life choices. What do you say we play a little You See Me Crying from Toys in the Attic? So you hear it in the background, an orchestra on this song, conducted by Mike Maneri. This is a Steven Tyler written song, along with Don Solomon. And apparently the rest of the band wasn't a real fan of it because it was a very complex arrangement with the piano and the orchestra and everything. So that's the reason that they give that they haven't really played this song live ever.
Well, I mean, you could have... because the keyboard player is going to be playing. Well, who would be playing the piano live? Would it be Steven?
That would be Steven, yeah.
So you could have the keyboard player supplementing parts. So you don't have to play the exact arrangement that you did in the studio.
But Steven plays piano on other songs live, so that's not the issue.
He does Dream On live every day.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So you could have him on piano. You could have the keyboard player supplementing the orchestral parts. Or at least some of it. I think it's doable live. There's a lot of parts, but you don't have to play them all.
And we talked about this on previous shows, play to a track, have the orchestra track playing in the background. As long as you're not miming along to it, like John pointed out, if you're not Milli Vanilli-ing it, it's such a beautiful song that it'd be nice to have that orchestra underneath everything, right?
Well, and the other thing that the band might have been unhappy with, too, is how much of the budget it took to record this song, because you have to hire all these other players. You have to hire somebody to print the parts on the sheet music. Then you have to pay somebody to be the copyist and make the sheets for everybody. John's waving at me.
They're fucking rock stars, and they were drugged out of their minds most of the 70s. And you think they're doing math?
Were they for Toys of the Attic? Toys in the Attic?
You think they gave a shit about the fucking budget?
Yeah, because it comes out of their pocket.
Oh, they don't give a shit.
They didn't know that probably at the time.
That might be.
Yeah.
But see, like for Uriah Heep, they did a song called Salisbury, which is a 16-minute song, and it's got a full string and wind section. And that was a huge part of their budget, which they didn't realize at the time would come out of their own pockets. They thought, oh, the record company pays for this and they'll get paid back in sales. Nope, comes out of their pocket. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just saying it could have been a factor of one of the reasons they didn't like it. I don't know. I wasn't there.
I think that by the time they knew that was a problem, they would have already had several opportunities to play the song.
Could be.
Yeah.
I think, remember, this is the mid-70s where bands were giving away their publishing for like an extra line of coke. Like they didn't realize, was it Tom Petty said, he thought publishing was, reprinting lyrics in songbooks. He didn't realize it was actually the rights to his song. That's why he fought so hard to get the rights back during the whole Damn the Torpedoes era. So, what John says, I think, carries a lot of weight. I love these bings. I'm just going to keep... So I don't know what's causing
that. I was just going to ask you where that's coming from, yeah.
It's from the Angels. Not sure. I wonder if I can play the song. Let's try it. You see me crying, don't let it get you down. You see me crying, I'm back to the lost and found.
really love his vocal there. Like, even though he's very well known for doing those pitch bends like that, he's got the vibrato in the beginning, then it goes into that gruff ending. Like, that is such a fantastic transition. That's part of what makes me like this song. Like, I really feel like he's feeling everything he's talking about here.
Oh, I agree. And that's why I found this next quote or this next story really kind of funny. Back in 1984, during the Back in the Saddle tour, which is kind of the reunion tour after Joe Perry and Brad Whitford came back in the band, there's a DJ at a radio station interviewing Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, and he started playing this song, You See Me Crying. And Tyler liked the song so much, he suggested Aerosmith record a cover version of it, to which Joe Perry had to respond, "It's us, fuckhead." But Tyler was suffering from memory problems due to heavy drug use. He forgot that was their song.
Well, what's even funnier about that is in my two seasons I'm doing on the Magicians podcast, there are two full albums that Uriah Heep re-recorded their own songs with the lineups of the band at that time. So that's 39 songs they redid. And here Joe's like, "We're not doing this one song because it's us."
But like you said, Uriah Heep did that. And that's everybody's doing that nowadays. They're just re-recording old stuff. Def Leppard did it when they couldn't, you know, they re-recorded a bunch of their hits back when, because they wanted it on iTunes when the old record company wouldn't give them access to their catalog for iTunes.
Oh, yeah.
U2 just did it. They decided to record a bunch of shitty covers of their own songs. Like, it's, I don't know what the hell the appeal is. Like, I'm not going to, if I own the Joshua Tree, I'm not going to go out and buy this new fucking record with them doing worse versions of those songs.
Yeah, there's so much that goes into it. It's part the production, which is a good part of the personality of the song, especially now because everything's going to be recorded digitally. You also have the performances where the band was at the time. I'm in general, I'm not a fan of that. I think, honestly, it's more of a cash grab than anything else. I don't see any other reason for it.
Corey, let me ask you a question. We do a movie podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they got this Flash movie coming out.
Yep.
And like 70-something-year-old Michael Keaton's coming back and playing Batman. Mm-hmm. You okay with that?
Because he's not redoing the first Batman movie? Yes.
Have you seen the latest trailer? Because he's saying several lines.
No, I haven't seen the latest trailer. The one that dropped at CinemaCon today, I haven't had a chance yet.
So I can tell you right now, two out of his three most iconic lines, including "You want to get nuts, let's get nuts," are in this trailer, right? And the very famous "I'm Batman." If he turns around and says, "You know, you ever dance with the devil by the pale moonlight," he'll have the trifecta. And I'm telling you now, it's the same freaking thing. So if you're excited about one, then you should be excited about both. And if you're not excited about one, I decided today, officially, I am not excited about this anymore.
Well, see, and I never was about the Flash, but I'm going to disagree with you, because to me, it's more like he's playing the greatest hits on tour than he is re-recording an entire album differently.
Yeah, I mean, if he and Kim Basinger got together and said, "Hey, let's redo our movie that people really liked, and here's the script, I saved it." And they just went and reshot it with the current technology and whatever. Yeah. But isn't in the Batman series, saying "I'm Batman" just like in Star Wars, where every movie has to have somebody saying, "I have a bad feeling about this"?
So let's be clear about this. You think that, keep in mind, before Michael Keaton, the only Batman we really had was Adam West.
Yeah.
Adam West never turned around and said, "Commissioner, I'm Batman." That was never a thing.
He didn't have to, Michael motherfucker. Keaton. Everyone knew he was Batman.
That's right.
Right. Michael Keaton's the one who turned the "I'm Batman" line into an iconic thing that people have tried to replicate.
But on the flip side of that, to be fair, in all of the Batman movies that have come since Adam West, we didn't actually have to put kablammo on the screen to let people know what the sound was that was being played.
I don't think you understand. Adam West hit people so hard, those words appeared on the screen.
It's true.
He just punched letters out of people.
Exactly. You notice he didn't need, the hard plastic bodysuit with the abs cut into it and shit, right? Like, that was pure West.
That's true. That's very true. I think Affleck was the only other one that didn't need some kind of...
Oh, no. He had fucking suit enhancements. Absolutely.
Oh, did he? Okay. I but still haven't seen that one yet.
He didn't need them, but he had them.
Yeah, he didn't need them, but he had them.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. But and to John's original point, I remember being on a call with John not that long when the first Flash trailer dropped, and I said, yeah, it looks fine. And everyone gave me shit. This is going to be the greatest fucking movie ever. Michael Keaton's back. I'm like, yeah, but what's he doing? And now here's John kind of agreeing with me now, saying, yeah, he's just doing the same shit. And that's kind of what I thought when I watched the Flash trailer. I thought, oh, this might be okay. It's nothing earth-shattering. It wasn't my most anticipated movie of this summer. To me, that's still Indiana Jones or Guardians of the Galaxy 3. I think they're kind of tied right now.
Yeah.
John is giving me a look like, what? Those two?
I'm interested to see Indiana Jones. I'm hoping that they make a comeback from the last one, because I didn't really like the last one that much.
No one did. But there's nowhere to go but up.
Yeah. But let me ask you. So, John, if Aerosmith got back together and re-recorded Toys in the Attic, say all the original guys, Joey Kramer's in, they're all clean and sober, would you buy the album?
No.
I don't think I would either.
Yeah. I don't think I would either. I don't think I'd even, I mean, I might just listen to it just to hear the sonic quality and what the recording was like, but I don't think I would really invest in any of the songs, because this is what they felt. This is what came out. Anything else is just trying to recapture. It's not in the moment.
I will tell you this though. If an artist like Pink or something decided to put something like that together where she went off and remade Toys in the Attic, I might be intrigued.
Well, I would, that yeah, would be absolutely different. Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about that covers album, and there was some good stuff on that. But and to that point, here's a little different scenario where we have Def Leppard. They're putting out an album called Drastic Symphonies, which they're taking, and they're not re-recording tracks, as far as I could tell, because the first thing they released was a version of Animal. It's the original 87 vocal tracks to an orchestral redoing of Animal, and it sounds fucking hideous. And like, I'm a big Def Leppard fan, but this is the first album I'm not going to go buy, because it's Def Leppard in 87, their vocals over top of an orchestra doing these songs, and it sounds terrible.
Is it the orchestra just playing along, or does the orchestra have its like its own arrangement?
I think it's its own arrangement, because it's actually considerably slower than the original rock version.
Yeah that's
again, that's cash grab. There's no other reason for doing that other than cash grab. I mean, if you're going to do that, do a live tour with an orchestra.
Exactly. Just like, it's like when Metallica did it, right? That was something, because they did it at a live show with an orchestra on stage with them, and they were playing along with them. This isn't even that. This is, we're going to take the vocal tracks from 87 or whatever album they're doing, even Pyromania in 83, and we're going to get the Royal Philharmonic to do an arrangement of it, and we're just going to put the vocals over top.
Yeah, that sounds like a record company cash grab idea. And the thing is, the band might not even be involved in that.
They're pretty excited about it. Yeah, and
Oh, okay.
It's all over their website and stuff. They were so happy they pumped out Animal, and I played a little bit of it. I'm like, this is fucking garbage. Like, if you want to play with an orchestra, that's one thing. Like, yeah, Metallica's music with the orchestra, both S&M and S&M 2. Mm-hmm. I love those records. Like, they're absolutely fantastic. But to me, this is just lazy. Like, if you're not in a room playing with them, what's the fucking point?
Right. Well, there's no unity either. And you can feel that typically in the music. I saw when Deep Purple was doing their orchestral tour, I saw them here in Vegas. I came up from Phoenix to see that, and it was amazing, you know. But the parts that they had written for the orchestra were very intelligent. It wasn't just playing along with the guitar or something. It was like really interesting parts. I did like some of the Metallica stuff. I saw them doing Call of Cthulhu live, and I thought it was amazing, absolutely amazing, and Master of Puppets. If you're going to do it as a studio thing, that's just somebody at a record company going, I know how we can make some more money.
I wonder if it's someone from the band saying, here's a way we can maybe make some more money. Because Def Leppard was a band I used to like respect a lot, and I've seen them live like 3 or 4 times. I went to Vegas, and I got to meet them. When they were doing Viva Hysteria, they played Hysteria in its entirety. One of my favorite concert experiences of all time. Yeah. But now they're on the stadium tour. They're playing the tracks, and they're just miming it. They're phoning it in. It's like, and now they're pumping this out as being a big thing. Losing some respect for these boys.
The only thing I could defend And I could kind of see a little bit of desperation, not just for themselves, but maybe for like their road crew and everybody else, is how much money everyone lost in potential income during COVID because no one could tour. Album sales, they don't make that much on those anymore. But I have to wonder if maybe that might be part of it. Like some bands like Purple and Uriah Heep were selling t-shirts that all of the proceeds went to their road crew because the bands weren't the only people that were suffering from COVID. Their whole road crew wasn't working either.
That's right. Yep.
You know, and they aren't going into the studio. So now you've got your producers and everybody else who can't work. I mean, it really was a very devastating thing for most industries. So if it's something like we need to do something to make some money back, I kind of at least understand the premise behind it, but I don't back the idea of it. And whether or not like Def Leppard was involved in the decision, I don't know. But I know with a lot of bands, they don't own the rights to their music. So it oftentimes these things happen without their consent at all.
That's right. And more are selling off their catalogs to get that payment right away so they could, you know, mm-hmm. spend it while they're still alive as opposed to leaving their heirs vast fortunes. What do you think, John?
I think it's a bunch of shit. Like if you want me to buy new music, play new music. And even if you want me to buy old music, play it in a new way. Mm-hmm. Right? Like when Metallica did the S&M thing, I was all over it. I still think it's a fantastic album. It's a great concert. It's great for what it is. I'm not into this whole remixing. Hey, we can overdub over something. I could care less. I could give a rat's ass. Don't do this shit. And if you're going to do this shit, just know I ain't buying it.
Amen, brother. We're all in agreement. You know who's not doing that right now is Aerosmith.
Well, I'll just say, except for Injustice for All, if they did a proper mix of that album with maybe some drum replacement, I would buy that in a heartbeat.
But that's just the remix. If they want to add some new drums to that and fucking Saint Anger, because those drums are the worst sounding drums maybe in recorded history.
Yeah,
I would be okay with that too. My wife asks me that every night, honey. What you done to your head?
I know this was early on in their career, but you're really seeing all the classic Steven Tyler tricks, right? The long pitch bends, the long sustained note. But there's something about his voice. There's like a gruffness in his voice that's really coming out in this song that I've always really enjoyed. I think it, like I said before, it really makes me feel like he's in a moment here.
Yeah, and really this whole album. Like when you talk about Toys in the Attic, which was their third record, they really had their shit down by this point. Like they'd obviously been playing together forever. You know, the first album was kind of hit and miss. We had Steven singing that whole other voice. Get Your Wings, you know, had some decent stuff on it, but it wasn't a huge hit. Toys in the Attic is really what exploded the band, right? Like that had Sweet Emotion and Walk This Way. And You See Me Crying was the third single off this one. To the point where apparently during the recording, one of the guys from Columbia Records, the Bruce Lundvall, the then president of Columbia Records, walked into the recording sessions for Toys when the band were working on this song and remarked, "You guys got an incredible thing going here. I just came from a Herbie Hancock session, and this is much more fun."
Wow.
More fun than Herbie Hancock? Like that's
a compliment right there.
No kidding. But I agree totally. Like the production, of course, Jack, though, this top notch. Steven sounds great. I'm looking forward to some guitar because it's actually Brad Whitford playing lead on this, not Joe Perry.
Oh, interesting.
Got a few of those lately.
Yeah. Yeah, especially lately. We actually, the last song we did, didn't Brad play lead on that, on The Hand That Feeds?
Yeah, because that was the one that Joe didn't even remember recording the song.
That's right. He wasn't even there. He was just passed out in his bed. Yeah.
Right.
Say you're one ladies' man. You see me cry, yeah.
Okay, so I have a question. I've had the lyrics wrong. I'm not much of a lyrics guy anyway, but I've had the lyrics wrong for years because I thought it was "Honey, what you done to your hair?" So I was wrong there. But the second line has always confused me. I always thought it was weird to say "Honey, was the words I said." The first two times here on the lyrics, they have it "Was it the words I said?" But I'm not hearing him say that. What I'm hearing him say is "Honey, was the words I said," which is how the lyrics are in the second verse here on the lyrics that we're looking at. What do you guys think it actually is?
I think it's the second, like you said, "Honey, was the words that I said," is what, kind of what I heard.
I think that the "it" is implied, and I think that there's autistic license here.
Autistic or artistic?
Both.
Okay.
50 of one, half a dozen of the other, something like that.
50 of one, half a dozen of the other.
I can't math.
I hear you. It's late in New York. I got you.
But what I can tell you is, I think he's taking a little bit of artistic license. But this is, you know, Scott kind of alluded to it. This is Steven Tyler at the height of his powers, mm-hmm. right? Like it's not about enunciating every syllable to get like the actual meaning of it. His word, his feeling gets "Honey, it's the word I say," right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever he's trying to say there, mm-hmm. it's projected in his vocals, right? That there's a longing, right? And there's not just like Corey and I just covered a very melancholy song on our other show, and it was melancholy for the sake of being melancholy. It was a Smashing Pumpkins song. I'm not a fan. Corey was not a fan of the song. I'm just not a fan of the Pumpkins in general. Mm-hmm. But we covered it. But this is a song that projects a melancholy feeling without being like super depressing to listen to.
Yeah, he's longing for someone, right? Like, "I'm back, yeah. Lost and found. Don't let it get you down. Say you're a ladies' man. I'm so hard to understand." Like, there's real longing, not only in his delivery, but in the lyrics as well.
And I'm wondering if there's a little bit of guilt in there. Like, what have you done to your head? Is it because of something I did? Like, I wonder if there isn't maybe a little bit of taking responsibility in this too.
Right, yeah.
But I'll say from a production standpoint, I would not change a damn thing on the song. This is so perfectly mixed and balanced. Kudos to the engineer who mixed this album.
Yeah, and lyrically, remember, this is on the same album that features a song where the lyrics are, "You ain't seen nothing till you're down on the muffin." That kind of shows you the range of one Steven Tyler as a lyricist.
And big 10-inch record.
That's right.
Another song we listened to recently off of one of the more recent albums where Steven tries to achieve what he's doing here, and it was so grating on that song because he no longer has that range. Mm-hmm. But here, what if he tried to do this now, and one of the reasons why they probably don't perform the song is that this is exceptionally difficult, like what he's hitting here.
Yeah.
And the way he's hitting it, to not make the arms on your, you know, the hairs on your arm stand up in a bad way, right? Like, it's almost like now it could be nails on a chalkboard, and he doesn't quite get to that level. And musically, there is something there that really adds to the pain and agony of this song. I don't know if you guys are feeling that too, but that's where I'm at.
Oh, 100%. And actually, I'm reading a couple of reviews here, and Cashbox called this, quote, "a rock ballad sure to raise nodules on your turntable." That's kind of what you're describing, John. Yeah, I agree 100%.
Yeah, the only thing that kind of lets me down on this song, to be honest, is this last verse that we just heard, because it sounds like he's saying, yeah, whatever's wrong, let me just fuck you and it'll all be okay.
Yeah, let me take you to town. I'll show you everything that I know and I'll never let you go because my love is like a merry-go-round. Yeah.
But I love the way that this verse comes in, because the way that the drums drop out and then it comes in with the drum fill after he starts singing, as opposed to the drum fill leading into it, is really nice. And then the music that's backing him is just as emotional with the strings as the actual lyrics and the performance of the lyrics are. This song is just such a hit for me.
What did we think of the guitar work there from Mr. Brad Whitford?
John?
I think it's some of that solo is one of my favorite solos Aerosmith puts out, and it's not a Joe solo. And that doesn't, I think it's, for me, it's not about Joe versus Brad, right? It's just like, if you rate the solos of Aerosmith, I will put this up against any of the solos in any of the other songs. I think it performs favorably, or at least it's in the conversation with. I think that speaks to how great this song is. That we have a. This doesn't seem like it's a song that would have a guitar solo to it, right? Yeah. Like it's a ballad, and not only does it have one, it has one that kind of steals the show a little bit. And I don't know that I need the orchestra in this song. Like, it's there. But if this were performed live, I wouldn't miss it.
Yeah, I think you could do the song without it and be just fine. I do like the strings in the first half of the solo, just that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, just kind of filling in a little bit. I feel like this is really a two-section solo. The first section, I feel, was almost spontaneous, and the second section very obviously charted out because it matches the strings and the progression of the strings. But it's played with such great feeling, and it just draws me in every time I hear it. And I've heard this song. This is probably my most listened to Aerosmith song, and maybe in like my top 30 most listened to songs, period. And even now, as I'm hearing the solo again, it just pulls me right in.
Always love that moment. Sorry to bust in, but just the everything's coming down. Steve goes, and then the piano kicks in again. Perfection.
That is really nice. And to John's point from earlier, I didn't think about this before, but you would kind of would have expected that it would have been a piano solo we would have gotten instead of a guitar solo, just because the piano is the lead instrument on the song. I really do like that switch.
All right, that's You See Me Crying, the album closer from the legendary album Toys in the Attic. What do we think about that as the album closer? You know, this is an album that features, of course, Toys in the Attic, Walk This Way, big 10-inch record, Sweet Emotion, No More, No More, Round and Round, and then the final track on side two is You See Me Crying.
I always look at an album as if you play it from start to finish and then put the album back on, does it loop well? And I think that this is a song that really has a finality to it. It's a great album ender. And then if you go back into Toys in the Attic, so you're kind of letting all the emotion out in this song, and it just frees you up to start into another rock song. So if this were just an album track somewhere in the middle, I would have expected another up-tempo song to follow it. So going into Toys in the Attic from this at the start of the album, I think works great.
Never thought of it that way. John Mariano, your final thoughts on You See Me Crying?
I don't know if they're my final thoughts, but they are some of my thoughts. In all seriousness, we're kicking something off the mixtape tonight. I don't know what side we're kicking something off of, but we are kicking something off the mixtape.
Well, this was a single, even though it didn't chart. It was released as a single in 1975, which means You See Me Crying would get a spot potentially on the all-time Aerosmith Top 9, which currently includes Let the Music Do the Talking, Chip Away the Stone, The Other Side, My Fist, Your Face, Crazy, Eat the Rich, Mama Kin, Shut Up and Dance, and Deuces Are Wild. You know what? I'm going to start because I never start. And I'm going to vote that I believe You See Me Crying deserves a spot on the all-time Aerosmith Top 9. And I would recommend My Fist, Your Face be replaced with You See Me Crying. Scott Haskin, what do you think?
Yeah, I could second that. I like My Fist, Your Face. I think it's a really good song. But this one, I mean, like I said, it's one of my most listened to songs, period. And it wouldn't be hard to convince me of any of these songs to kick off the tape. I like My Fist, Your Face, but so long.
All right, John?
You know what my favorite play in baseball is?
I don't know, bunt?
Oh, no, the triple play.
Okay.
So you got the first out, Scott's got the second out, and here I am coming around, and I get the third out. And we're all in agreement. My Fist, Your Face is out.
And like Scott said, not a bad track. I really dug that one. I know when I teased the episode, I kind of put a tweet out there, you know, who's ready for some Done With Mirrors? And a couple of people were like, no. One guy went, meh. So it's not their most well-liked album, even though I'm a fan of it. But I dug that track, and I'm glad it was on there, but it didn't last very long. You See Me Crying, I think, absolutely deserves a spot on the all-time Aerosmith Top 9. So we're all in agreement. You See Me Crying takes his rightful spot among the Top 9, at least for the time being. But Scott Haskin, this is a rare position for you, my friend. You get to replace a song on the mixtape for like the first time ever.
Yeah.
You See Me Crying is gone. What are you thinking that you want to replace it with?
Well, I know what John Mariano was expecting. I see the half grin on his face right now, just predicting whether I'm going to pick another Permanent Vacation or another Toys in the Attic song. And just because of what he did to me last week and tried to do to me yet again on this episode, I'm just going to blow his mind. I'm going to pick Don't Get Mad, Get Even from Pump.
Ooh,
interesting.
I think that's the most appropriate song I could pick.
I'd say a deeper cut off Pump, but I'm not mad at it. John, what do you think of that selection?
I think it's fine. I think we totally glossed over part of the show, but I think it's a good selection.
What do you mean we totally glossed over part of the show?
Oh, well, because while we might have removed the song from the side of the mixtape, we never gave it the opportunity to live on, we do with so many other songs, specifically one particular one I'm thinking of right now.
You're right, 100%. I completely screwed up. My Fist, Your Face. It's a double elimination tournament here, folks. It's got the opportunity to live on somebody's nasty cuts. Let's remind you all what those selections are. John's three cuts are Walk on Water, Cheesecake, and Bright Light Fright. Scott has The Movie, Nobody's Fault, and Hangman Jury. I have Falling in Love is Hard on the Knees. JD's Got a Gun, and You Gotta Move. John, since you put it on my air once again, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking, like, if you want to nominate it for one of Scott's songs, specifically one that might relate to one of our podcasts, I wouldn't be opposed to it, but I'm not removing it for one of my songs.
Okay, so you're suggesting we put My Fist, Your Face in place of the movie.
Oh, that's a great suggestion, Corey. We should do that.
Okay. Scott, what do you think?
I remember when John was a co-host on the show. It was a lot of fun. No, I think it's good. I think the three selections I've got, I'll keep. But I want to point out, as a side note of interest to you, Corey, I had marked Janie's Got a Gun in red because I hated that song.
Right.
And after our episode on it last time, you convinced me to move it up to orange.
So what does orange mean?
So orange is I don't hate it and I don't love it, as opposed to I hate it, which is what red meant.
Oh, okay.
As you can imagine, I might have a song like Sheila in red.
You really got something against Sheila. Did you used to date a Sheila that wronged you in some way?
No, not at all. I just hate that song. It's hideous. But I have bumped up Janie's Got a Gun.
Well, that's good to know. John, so Scott doesn't want to replace any of his cuts. I don't get it either. But you have three that you could replace with My Fist, Your Face. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking My Fist, Your Face is my least favorite movie I've seen.
I know, but technically, we can't take one of Scott's choices off of Scott's Nasty Cuts because we're not Scott.
But what happened to the rule we established at the top of the show where, like, one of my songs has to come off the mixtape at some point and I don't get to replace it and Scott gets to replace the movie for Scott as a punishment?
I remember that was suggested. I don't think that bill was actually ratified.
Corey?
Do we have a quorum even? I don't know. What is the voting procedure for Backtracks Aerosmith Revisited? What's in the bylaws?
It's a point of parliamentary procedure. We have to check with the listeners and they should vote.
Okay. So anybody listening to this, please reach out on our social media channels. Won't be Facebook because we're blocked on Facebook for some reason. Scott yes. tried valiantly to get us a Facebook page. Didn't work. But we are on the...
Oh. There's an aftermath to that, which is even though they wouldn't allow the page, they have changed the name of my homepage to Scott Haskin Aerosmith or Backtracks Aerosmith Revisited.
Really?
They wouldn't give me the page, but they've changed my homepage to that. So when I tell people what my Facebook page is, that's how it comes up.
That makes no sense.
Nope.
That's fantastic.
So please reach out to Scott on Facebook. Call him at home. Look up his number. He lives in Las Vegas. He'll answer day or night, 24 hours a day. He loves answering Facebook messages. And just let him know. Apparently, in our bylaws, we go to a public vote on whenever a new bylaw is enacted. I'm not sure how this works. I missed a couple of meetings. John usually chairs those. So I'm kind of lost when it comes to the parliamentary procedure of the show.
In Corey's defense, the roads were very bad in Saskatchewan that day.
Oh, you have no idea. Like, we were literally storm stayed for 3 days. We didn't leave the house.
Wow. I don't leave the house for 3 days, but that's voluntary.
Understood. If I lived in Vegas, I'd probably do that too. But yeah. Maybe we should put a ball in this one since John's not getting the movie replaced this week. John, what do you got to promote? What do you got coming up and where can the folks find you?
Oh, you can find me on a little show called Backtracks Theme Music where we discuss much more enjoyable movies than we do on the show.
Ouch. Scott Haskin, where can the fine folks find you?
I have to give props to John for his very inventive ways of taking digs at one of my favorite Aerosmith songs. Well, you guys can find me on www.scotthaskin.com. By the time this airs, I should have two more books on Amazon to enjoy.
Just in a week, he writes two more books. Like you're making us look bad here, buddy.
Well, the challenge was actually learning how to do the covers myself instead of hiring out this time. That took a day and a half to just figure out the everything involved with that. It was a challenge, but now I know how to do it.
Well, I got to tell you, we have a graphic artist on this call who I'm sure could have helped you with some cover art for your book. It might have had the words of the movie with a red line through it, but it would have been something.
It wasn't the cover art that was the challenge. It was learning how to do the text placement and the sizing and everything to get it within the because when you do a book that's going to be in physical print, the spine is going to be based on the number of pages. So every template is individual to that book based on the number of pages. And figuring out how to do like the vertical but sideways written text for the side of the book, the spine, and then, you know, the placement and sizing for everything else, how to do the colors over the picture. It was a lot of fun, but really challenging, and screw ever having to learn anything ever again.
But can you tell us any more about this book? I'm assuming there's going to be a heroic prince-like character named Corey fighting some sort of evil troll dragon named Bariano or something like that. Is that accurate?
Trolliano. It's actually the first book is called, I don't know what the final title was. I think it was #inspiration #cloudporn for creatives and non-creatives, which is 55 cloud pictures that I've taken with inspirational or motivating phrases, whether you're a creative. Some are project related and some are not. And then the other book is sarcasm or #sarcasm #cloud porn. And it is storm pictures or dark cloud pictures with sarcastic phrases, probably inspired by John Mariano.
Well, that I was just going to say, this sounds very John-esque. How many did you steal from John? And do you have a lawyer? Because if John reads any of those quotes and they come from him, expect litigation.
You know what's funny is I actually just went through my Facebook feed and a conversation log I have with a friend of mine who's another author. And I had so many things that fit the book that I said just in those locations that actually is the entire book.
And just to be clear, there would be no litigation, Corey. It'd be an open and shut case, and there'd be a settlement. And the settlement would be we get this fucking song off the mixtape.
I love that. That would be your only term.
You can take Walk on Water off anytime you like.
All right. Well, join us next week when the raging war between Scott Haskett and John Mariano continues over the movie. But until then, on behalf of Scott and John, my name is Corey. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Backtracks Aerosmith Revisited. And as always, let's give the final word to Scott Haskett.
Thank you.